Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to The Game, the podcast that delves into the most intriguing talking points across football today. I'm your host, Rob Fletcher, and today we are tackling a topic that raises fundamental questions about modern football. Does it matter who owns our football clubs? Always a contentious subject, this one. I'm joined by two of the TFT team to work out if who's in charge off the pitch is as important as who is in charge on it. So both guests support clubs with interesting ownership story, shall we say. Both support a team in blue. But first up, we've got Gary Thacker in the blue of Chelsea. Welcome to the podcast, Gary.
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, as you say, a fascinating subject and plenty to get our teeth into here, but it's going to be a great chat.
Definitely. In the other blue corner, we've got Matthews, Team Birmingham. We've had a very checkered past in the boardroom, shall we say, from Karen Brady to Tom Brady. Welcome to the podcast, Matthew.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. Yeah, it's going to be it's going to be an interesting one.
Certainly is. And obviously on this podcast, we try and keep it one topic, short and snappy, and we chat through some of the issues in modern football. So let's sort of get underway, really. Gary, football ownership is a contentious subject in the modern game, but it hasn't always been that way. Often it was, you know, one chairman, one family that owned the football club. And it was sort of the 80s and 90s, wasn't it, where football ownership starts to sort of change around a little bit.
Yeah, I suppose it's like so many things in life, you know. As money became bigger, so the sort of attraction for other people to own clubs rather than the local butcher, baker and candlestick maker became more and more apparent, and people started buying clubs to make money. And there used to be the old saying that, you know, the way to make a small fortune on a football club, start with a large fortune. But I think that's probably flipped a bit now, and, you know, you get people, these businesses buying football clubs there. And that's increasingly, from the date you mentioned, you know, 80s go through 90s, Premier League, advent of the Premier League, and obviously, yeah, through them. Just an interesting point where you know, with the sort of intro you said, who owns our football club, does it matter? I always think, you know, with that sort of thing, the question is, who to? It matters less to a fan of a football club if their club's winning. They couldn't care less. But from the outside, I mean, Man City fans currently would probably say, I don't care. Everybody else looking outside of Man City would probably think, well, that's just a terrible situation. So it's a fascinating subject, Rob, yeah.
It is, certainly. I think that perspective element, that who is answering the question, is such an important one, isn't it? And I think, especially when you go through the 80s into the 90s, football owners started to look at themselves a little bit differently, more like, actually, we want to make a little bit of cash from this, you know, rather than trading players and sort of breaking even every year. It was maybe time to make a little bit of profit. And certainly into the early 90s, when the Premiership era arrives and there's more TV money floating around, there's certainly a lot more money available to clubs to use. Would you say, Matthew, now we're probably, if we kind of jump forward a little bit, we're probably starting to hit an era where these sort of institutions, if we want to call it that, are now probably more like a brand that people are buying into, more than, you know, the bricks and mortar of a stadium, a training ground, a group of players, a set of fans. It is more kind of a, you know, I'm investing in a Nike or an Adidas. It's kind of the similar thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm going to make a lot of comparisons to American sports in this podcast today, what with all the American owners in English football especially. But I think that's a good point when you look at how the top level American teams are perceived, where you have your New Yorks and Chicagos and all that, representative of states, representative of millions of people, rather than what football in England is, which is representative of smaller communities based in a certain area, like the east part of a city or something. And then you take that, what was once representative of a small community, and turn it into something that is, yeah, we're owned by Coca-Cola now or something. It's a real radical shift in perspective and radical shift in ownership and radical shift in what they will do with the clubs in the future. I think we're really getting to a point where I think the Super League, all that sort of stuff, will rear its head again at some point. And when you have a team that is, we are, I can't even know who owns who at the minute, but we are Bournemouth owned by Coca-Cola and we're going to go join the Super League. I think it's a worrying trend the way football ownership is heading at the minute.
it's very much a little bit like what's happened in sort of the television, music and film industry, where you have these mega sort of conglomerates now, where you might have had, you know, the five main studios in Hollywood, but now actually they own the film studio, they own the music, they own the TV stations that the movies can be shown on. So everything is kind of under one roof almost. And I think it's quite interesting that we've not had models around, you know, I own a football club, I own the men's and women's team, I own the basketball team. I suppose in England, we've not really got the tradition of other sports being at the same level compared to sort of somewhere like America, where you've got a lot of owners who've got a stake in a basketball team and an NHL team and an NFL team. So it's kind of that sort of conglomeration of football hasn't quite changed. But Gary, from your point of view, as a Chelsea fan, obviously a lot of boardroom struggle, shall we say, probably in the 1990s for Chelsea with the direction of the club, who was investing what, should it be in the stadium, in the infrastructure, should it be on the pitch with the players. But probably a bit of a sort of football big bang moment was certainly Roman Abramovich's arrival into Chelsea. It drastically changed the football landscape in England, didn't it?
Just a bit, yeah. I remember the morning I was lying in bed, listening to the radio before getting up to foot, go to work, and it came on the news that Chelsea had been bought out by a Russian oligarch, and sort of like, what? But yeah, as you say, it was a wake up and smell the coffee big bang moment. Yeah, it did change. It's changed. And I guess it was the first sort of mega rich outsider taking over a football club and you know, basically distorting the balance of play in the league. And I suppose it was sort of, you know, it opened the door and shown what was probably going to happen over the next, well, and continues to happen now, two or half decades later. Yeah, it was. And you know, as a Chelsea fan, you know, and going back to what I referred earlier, does it matter who owns a football club? Well, it matters less if you're doing successful, I suppose. It's a little bit parochial, but there it is, it's true. Yeah, a wonderful period for Chelsea. I remember my son's a Chelsea fan, and his coming of age of football was just about when Abramovich took over, and he never knew anything other than that. So, you know, I always say I've been supporting Chelsea since the early 1960s. I've earned my glory. But there's a lot of nowadays Chelsea fans, sort of younger Chelsea fans, have never known anything. But and it's, you almost feel you're like, you haven't earned it. You've got to earn, you've got to go through the pain before you get to the glory. But yeah, I think that instantaneous desire now for glory is when somebody comes in and buys a football club now, make it like, you know, when the Saudi Arabian, sorry, North and bought Newcastle, it was almost like, well, we're going to be the best, we're the richest club in the world now, we're going to buy all these sort of players. And it hasn't actually worked out because of, and I don't know whether this is actually a positive thing for this profit and sustainability rules, whether that will be persisting, we will see. But it's yeah, when Abramovich turned up, it did open the door, and lots of people have pulled through that open door ever since.
And I think the Chelsea case, like you say, about right from the start, Gary, about who does it matter if it owns the club? If it had been Middlesbrough, if it had been Birmingham, and we suddenly had, you know, an infinite amount of wealth to improve our squads, we probably wouldn't really care. But I think if you've never had that, it has a really different sort of feeling and sort of complexion. Matthew, I mean, obviously, is, you know, our clubs are, you know, football league clubs or kind of yo-yo clubs between the sort of top division and the second division, as it were. It very much changes how you feel about your own club when you can't compete with such a massive financial boost to, I'm going to call it like a non-traditional top five club. Because at the time, Chelsea were obviously won trophies, won European trophies, had some really good players and some really exciting times. But they weren't part of that sort of breakaway group for the Premier League. They weren't kind of part of that usual core of, you know, your Man United, Arsenal, Liverpool, etc. It started to make you feel differently about your own club because, you know, owned by someone like Steve Gibson, who's been involved with the club since 1986, chairman since 1993. We couldn't compete, yet we were in the same league. It started, that chasm that now exists kind of started there, really, didn't it?
Yeah, and it's manifested itself in so many unfortunate ways, I think. I mean, if you just take a look at how many times in the last 3, 4, 5 years teams have been promoted to the Premier League and just cannot compete because everyone there is owned by billionaires now. You've got clubs like Aston Villa, Newcastle, all big teams, but not necessarily, like you said, traditional big six teams, but they're all richer than God. And now we're in a situation now where we're recording this, what, 6 or 7 games into the season? None of the promoted teams have won yet. And where's the next win coming from? Because they can't afford to compete with what already exists. And yeah, the chasm gets bigger and bigger and has really huge knock-on effects for the rest of the league. I mean, you mentioned I'm a Birmingham City fan. We've been taken over by a rich American hedge fund, and look at us splashing 20, 30 million in the third division. It was a real, like what you say, a real distortion of competitiveness. And yeah, it's all a bit, I mean, we're using Birmingham City as an example, we've been terrible for like 12 years. So there is an element of why can't we just enjoy it? And this has happened. It's kind of a nice thing. We're playing nice football. Why can't we just enjoy it? And yet can't help but feel it's a little bit unfair, isn't it? Like spending 30 million in the third division, and this distortion of English football to make it look like something you didn't used to is all a bit, yeah, leaves a bit of a sour taste in the mouth.
Can I just chuck something in here before we move on? I think we need to put a little bit of perspective into the situation as well. Money has always been important in football, and there's always been clubs who are richer than others. I mean, going back to the 50s, Sunderland were called the Bank of England Club because they could buy obviously the richest club. And so, you know, in the 70s and 80s, Manchester United were the richest club, and they could, you know, were buying a place. So there's always been that sort of power differential. I think the difference now is that differential has been expanded massively. And the gap between the, you know, the richest half dozen clubs in the Premier League and the perhaps less rich half dozen clubs is bigger than it's ever been. And it seems to me, unless, you know, one of those clubs gets a rich benefactor, it's only going to get bigger.
Yeah, and I think from the upcoming sort of series that we're doing around the 1990s, you can see that if you were a millionaire, you could quite easily put in 10, 20, 25 million to your local football club. Someone like Jack Walker, for example, a fan, you know, been a Blackburn fan all his life, put money in. I mean, now that would probably cover what, 3/4 of a striker?
A decent one.
And, you know, a club like Ipswich, actually, who are really well run. They've got a great coach. Recruitment's been really good. They've spent, I think, 115 million, I think. Probably going to get relegated, probably going to be well placed to challenge again the Championship the following season. But they've got incredibly rich owners. So even a club like Ipswich, who people might say, and I remember this coming up with Luton actually, I can't remember, was it Garth Crooks who said, what's the point in Luton? What's the point in Luton and being in the Premier League? And you kind of think, well, every football fan wants to dream, don't they? And I think ownership is part of that. When you see sort of the owners come over the hill, riding there, you know, the White Knight comes over the hill with their, you know, sword and shield ready to take on the world, you kind of always feel like that's not that far away from you, as in your club. But what I do think is, because of some of the profit and sustainability rules, that's a real challenge. Like, if Middlesbrough got taken over by a billionaire tomorrow, it probably wouldn't actually make that much difference. It would mean we've got someone who can cover our losses every year more easily than our multi-millionaire owner. And I think sometimes they're the things that promise, that expectation that we're going to be another Chelsea or a club we haven't mentioned yet, another Manchester City. And I think maybe, Gary, with Chelsea and Manchester City, you know, a lot of money's been spent on those clubs. And to be fair, they've developed a stadium. You know, they've sold hotels to themselves. City have built a whole coaching facility, academy facilities. They've regenerated some of the local area. But there's a little bit of an asterisk and a bit of a caveat over them as owners, isn't it, I suppose? Maybe not in those early days of Abramovich, but even the whole oligarch era in the 90s and how they all got rich, it does make it a little bit difficult talking about football when there's so many sort of off-the-field things that colour that ownership.
Yeah, of course there is. I mean, we sort of, as I mentioned, we were talking before we started recording this, there's lots of layers to this sort of discussion. And it's just a bit about Chelsea. Probably the Chelsea team that's benefited most from Abramovich's money and the other women's team, who are absolutely dominant in the Women's Super League and very successful in Europe as well. But coming back to it, I guess, you know, I mean, anybody who makes a lot of money very quickly has got going to have some asterisks over their name. So, I mean, anybody can afford to buy a football club. If it's an individual person, there's going to be asterisks over them anyway. And even some of the organisations that buy football clubs, you know, you can start delving into, you can find skeletons in lots of cupboards. And I guess that it was with Abramovich and the history, of the Russian Revolution is a bit more obvious. And certainly with Man City as well, there again, I think there's a slight difference in while perhaps Man City are disliked by a lot of non-Man City fans, is they seem to strut their power as well. This I don't know, this is 673,000 charges they got against them. I mean, and I think that the thing is with that is we all know as football fans, if the Premier League find them guilty and try to do anything, any sanction, any meaningful sanction, such as stripping of championships from past championships or banning them getting relegated or whatever, and the Premier League got 16 lawyers. Man City got 16,000 lawyers, and they're going to win because, you know, that's the power they have. And I think that's probably not true of Newcastle. It's not true of Chelsea there. I don't think it was even true of Chelsea under Abramovich. But Man City have got that sort of, as I say, that strutting power.
It's probably why we probably should not be allowing countries and nations to buy football clubs in other countries, because the geopolitical politics and the power that they have and the money that they have, all of that, it comes with too much baggage and too many problems and too many other things to think about when, as you say, you kind of just want to be thinking about the football. You want to be thinking about the sport and how it manifests itself on the pitch. But instead, you're talking about how Manchester City they have the ability to hire whoever they want to go against the Premier League. And all of this stems because they're owned by, I always actually forget who it is. It's UAE, the United Arab Emirates. But then all the baggage that comes with Newcastle being owned by Saudi Arabia, where they get taken over, and all of a sudden you're like, well, aren't these the guys that ordered the beheading of a journalist and the way that they treat women in their country? And you spend more time talking about non-football stuff than you do about how exactly are they going to help Newcastle and the city of Newcastle. It's all just too complicated that should never have been allowed to happen, and the Premier League and other parties did not really have the foresight to try and stop.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mentioned sort of, you know, and as Matthew referred to there, the Premier League haven't got the authority, the power, the real power, never mind the legal power, the written power, the actual power. But I think some of these football clubs now are that sort of powerful that neither of UEFA and perhaps neither of FIFA. The Super League was a sort of case in point, and to this day, I think I'm correct in saying that Juventus, Barcelona and Real Madrid are still members of that thing. Although it doesn't actually exist, they're still there. Now, imagine a scenario now if the Premier League wanted to relegate Man City. I'm only going to say Man City. I mean, it could be any, it could be Chelsea, it could be Newcastle, it could be any sort of mega wealthy club. Because of these charges, they want to relegate them, and they sort of say, you know, well, you know, we're going to fight in courts, and UEFA back them. Now, here's the situation. Man City then go to Barcelona, Real Madrid, Juventus, five or six Saudi Arabian clubs, mega rich again, and say, well, you know, I ain't interested in the Champions League anymore, guys. We're going to produce the Mediterranean League. So all of a sudden, you get Real Madrid, Barcelona, Juve, perhaps one of the Milan clubs, five or six clubs from Saudi Arabia, and they've stripped basically the power away from the ruling bodies. And this is the fear. The Super League was almost like a sort of Damocles that these rich clubs placed over the head of the authorities. And if we can't get our way sufficient to keep us happy, we're going to go away, and it's going to cost you loads of brass. And come the end of the day, you know, that's what football's all about, sadly.
And I think that's quite true, isn't it? That money talks aspect of football, I think, is so true in terms of you hold all the cards. I think the Premier League would know that if it didn't have a Manchester City or a Manchester United or a Liverpool as part of the league, it just wouldn't be as attractive. It's a little bit like when your club has to sell three or four of its best players, your results turn, your attendances go down, you earn less money. It's the same with all those things. It's actually the people, I mean, I don't want to call it the talent, but they're the ones who hold all the cards, really. If you think UEFA and FIFA, Premier League, your administrative bodies, like in reality, all they do is open the rules to allow growth. That's all it ever is. They're not really that bothered about that much else. And if anything, it should be the Premier League who are getting charged, as well as Manchester City, because they have allowed a lot of these situations to happen. Like I'd read, I think it was some 50 of the charges are around not submitting financial accounts at the right time, I believe. If you're a self-employed builder and you don't hand your tax return in, HMRC come knocking on your door probably within the 12 months that it should have been submitted. I mean, that to me, that seems totally normal, totally logical. If I'm self-employed, I've got to submit a tax return. If I'm a football club, what are we now? 2024, back end of 2024. Some of these charges refer to 2018. what was going on during that time with the Premier League that they couldn't just say, you failed to do this, it's a 5-point deduction, £20 million fine, done. If you don't do it again, you know, we'll make the fine suspended or whatever. You deal with that. But actually, I suppose our question about does it matter who owns the football clubs, maybe it matters more who regulates the football clubs than actually who owns them, because that's what actually creates the structures around these positive ownership models. Like Birmingham, for example, are not breaking any rules. Morally, we feel like they are. Do you know what I mean? Because we have these ridiculous morals as football fans, don't we? We think, how can they be buying Jay Stansfield for 15 million plus whatever? It doesn't matter. As long as your wages can only be 65% of your income, I believe, or 70% of your income, something like that in League One. There's no transfer limits because basically no one's got any money. So they thought, we don't need to put a transfer limit on because no one's got any money in League One anyway. So it almost doesn't matter. When actually, the question then comes is if you're owned, you know, in Birmingham, for example, and you'll probably know more about it than us, Matthew, but your stadium's got a different name, which I'm assuming came with a bit of a nice little sweetener as a bit of a premium. And then you're opening the doors to, you know, being a Wrexham, as it were, that kind of attention. Do you feel like as a fan of a club who's now got that investment, that as long as you're working within those structures and those rules, it maybe doesn't matter who owns the club, but it does matter that they follow those rules when you look at the sort of City example and the mess they've got everybody into right now?
So I would say I'm a little bit different to other Blues fans with this. I don't know. I think maybe I'm a bit of a hater, so I like to swim against the tide. So I don't like the sort of... There's a lot of celebration of the Blues owners from the Blues fans. It's very, very sycophantic. Like, we sing about these people at the stadium and stuff like that. I don't know. It's just... Sure, everything they've done so far, bar the Wayne Rooney appointment, has been great. But they are still really rich American hedge fund owners who take on distressed assets and flip it for profit. So all of what they're doing is not out of the goodness of the heart. They're not doing it for the love of the game, for the love of Birmingham. They're doing it to make a profit. They're going to build this new Manchester City-style sports quarter in the city, and they're going to sell the whole thing, who knows who to, and make a ton of money from it. So I don't really feel the need to celebrate them all that much, because what they're doing is great, but it's not like it's not for charity. They're not benefactors here. And in terms of what we're doing, I mean, it's important that we do play by the rules, and by all accounts, all the stuff that has been reported, we are doing that. We had a lot of players leave over the last 12 months who were on huge contracts, and it opens up a big big sort of space for PSR. Even if we were in the Championship, it would have opened up a big space for us to spend a lot of money. And then you go down to League, the third division, yeah, there's all these sort of something like... if you have a contract over 4 years, it doesn't apply to your PSR, which makes zero sense to me, but is one of those rules that they have in the third division. And so everything that we're doing is absolutely fine and legal, and doing it in a sensible business sense. But there is still the sort of, it just feels a bit wrong, because I don't know who the big spenders behind us were this summer, but they can't have spent more than 5 million. Maybe it's like Huddersfield or Charlton or something like that. I think Charlton spent a bit of money. It feels wrong, but that's maybe just because of the way that we have been moulded by British football for the last few decades, and it looks wrong when people spend money, when really there's nothing really wrong with it. And I mean, we're not even playing that well yet, so it's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I just want to chuck something in very briefly here. I guess as a Chelsea fan, here I am defending Roman Abramovich to some extent here, but as opposed to a lot of the sort of, what's the word, slightly dodgy owners, Roman Abramovich loved that club. When Chelsea won the European Cup, he cried. As pitchman crying and his son crying, and when we scored, you could see him he actually cares. And Matthew's right. I absolutely understand what he's saying. It's the attitude for the Birmingham owners and a lot of other people who own football clubs is fairly sort of clinical. The passion isn't there, the heart isn't there, the love isn't there. But certainly, you know, as I say, you know, qualifying a little bit for Roman Abramovich, that the passion, the love, the heart was certainly there for Chelsea.
I suppose on the cynical side of that, it's to what end? You know, why was he so emotionally attached? Was it, you know, a personally beneficial thing? Which, let's be brutally honest, you said it right sort of towards the start, Gary. People who invest in these clubs are generally doing it for personal gain. And do you know what? We all are, aren't we? You know, we go to football for personal gain of enjoyment or whatever we need.
Yeah, I think, you're right. Except for this case, I don't think you are right. he ploughed a lot of his own money in, not business money, his own money. And when he sold the club, basically gave the club away and wrote off a debt of £1.2 billion. Now, you know, I mean, you know, this isn't a guy who was there trying to make money. I mean, might be a little bit of personal insurance policy, you know, to keep out of the way of the bad guys in Russia and, you know, to... But, you know, as I say, a lot of people who buy these football clubs, you know, do it overwhelmingly. It's sitting on two of Man City. They didn't buy Man City to make money. It's just what you call sports washing thing. Perhaps the same as Newcastle, PSG, and, you know, a few other entities. But certainly Abramovich did not buy Chelsea to make money.
No, and I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? You're buying power rather than money, I suppose, these days with these English football institutions. It's probably no accident that Birmingham City were invested in and not a club like Middlesbrough or Sunderland, perhaps. You know, you're in the second city. You've got a huge kind of untapped potential there outside of London. Maybe even more cynically, they're building whatever they're building between Birmingham and London in terms of rail links. So it's closer to get to. I mean,
the new sports court is going to be right next to HS2 as well. So,
and let's be honest, I think, I can't remember who said, but if you're a billionaire, and you've earned it quickly. I think it was you, Gary. You're a billionaire and you've earned your money quickly. You're not stupid. You know what I mean? You've got all this dosh in your back pocket. And you're not... I mean, it might look like Todd Bowley and Chelsea and Clear Lake are trying to fritter away as much of their inheritance as possible. But actually, what they're trying to do, you can see, they're trying to set up a club for 5-10 years that can kind of not be investment-proof, but you've got a little bit there in terms of the age of the players, the contract lengths, all that sort of stuff. I suppose that's... The Chelsea ownership of the last two and a half years could be a whole other podcast in itself, I suppose. But for me, as a Middlesbrough fan, you know, we've had the same chairman criticised and praised in equal measure, probably. We dreamt in the 90s of becoming a Chelsea. You know, we got to a couple of finals, lost some finals, didn't stay up. We could have been in Europe if we'd have won one of them. Could we have attracted the players that would have got us in the top 10? We might have been a mainstay in the Premier League all the way through that. And then later on in the 2000s, after we'd got into the UEFA Cup, our chief executive told us that we were going to get the football club that Teesside could afford, which when you've sort of dared to dream and you've got to cup finals and whatever else, and you think, well, hang on a minute, you were the one spending the money, not us. We're happy to pay our money and support the club and be in the ground and wear the shirts. You can't all of a sudden turn around and say, oh, it's got a bit more expensive for us now. Let's see what, you know, we can afford. And obviously since then, we've had one season in the Premier League in 15 years. Does it mean I'd want to change our owner and maybe have a couple of billion in the bank? Maybe. I feel like I'd rather have probably the Brentford and Brightford. Brighton and Brentford model, where you've got maybe one individual, especially someone like Tony Bloom, who is a Brighton fan and kind of has built the club up to where it is today. I suppose that's still, even probably for you two as well, actually, Chelsea, Birmingham fans, you probably, if it was a local businessman with 10 billion, there probably wouldn't be that many questions, but maybe that's something for us to talk about. One thing I wanted to pause on while we talk about foreign ownership, and maybe we can go on to talk about some of the positive examples and the positive things and maybe some solutions that we might have for English football based on what goes on around the world. Leicester City, we probably have to mention, is probably a positive case study of foreign ownership. You know, owners that were loved by the fans, obviously tragically lost one of them in that awful incident that happened a good few years ago now. But yeah, they've bounced around between the Championship and the Premier League. And I think they might have even had, did they have a stint in League One at one point? Possibly, I think, under Pearson got them up. But they've won a Premier League. They've been in the Champions League. They've won an FA Cup. They've been relegated again. They've come back up again. I suppose, despite their financial restrictions, Matthew, a club like Leicester, probably, you know, let's say a second tier level club like a Middlesbrough or a Birmingham or whoever we want to say, but they've had that success consistently with that ownership group.
They are an interesting one because I think they are both a cautionary tale of we keep using these terms, I hate these terms, but like second tier club trying to make it into the big time to try and transition from that team that finishes 8th, 9th, 10th to Champions League under Brendan Rodgers. But also how football is not immune to what happens outside. And I'm fairly sure I'm right in saying this, that Leicester City, the owners are, that's something to do with duty-free in airports, right? So they were massively screwed over by the pandemic, by COVID-19, because there was like 2 years where nobody was getting on planes and nobody was going to duty-free. And it totally had this devastating effect on their revenue stream. So it meant they had less to invest in Leicester and while the wages at Leicester keep getting bigger and bigger because of the way football clubs offer players contracts with massive bonuses, and which is why wages for clubs get so huge. They had less money coming in, so there was this big divide that led to them having to sell Wesley Fofana for however much money that was. It's an interesting one, and I hear what you say when you say it's a good example of foreign ownership. I don't know if they would change anything though, would they? Like the fans, I know they've been bouncing around the last few years and it's been a bit miserable. And they didn't even really like last season when they got promoted under Maresca. But if you've won a Premier League and an FA Cup in the last 10 years at a time of such big six dominance, I guess they probably wouldn't change anything.
And you can dare to dream in that time, because all of these sort of, let's inverted commas, call them smaller owners with a small S, they are only ever going to have a finite amount of success anyway, because the big clubs won't let it happen again. It's a little bit like your European Super League point, Gary, where, you know, they've been told no once. Will they be told no again if Manchester City suddenly get a 90-point deduction, or they get relegated or stripped? They're not going to turn around and say, oh, do you know what? We hold our hands up. We'll have a season in the Championship where we try and rebuild. I mean, it's not going to happen, is it? It's not going to happen. Have we got any other good examples of ownership models where we can look at and think, do you know what, that might work? So I'm thinking, for me, so being on Merseyside, obviously Everton are getting a new owner, American owners, it's another hero coming again to save the club, put them back where they belong. You know, they're in the big five, they were the breakaway when the Premier League came and all that sort of stuff. Is it going to be more of the same, or is there a better model out there? We've got these Americans buying 10%, 20%, then 40%, then taking the whole club. What do we need to look at? As a league, as a nation, you know, whether it's a regulator or whatever, what are the good examples and how are we going to make it work?
Oh, that's a great question, really. Over here in Spain, the biggest clubs, I mean, we're talking Real Madrid, Barcelona, the biggest clubs are owned by the fans. Now, you know, fan ownership in British football, English football, isn't terribly unknown, but it's really, really at a low level. So we're talking about Exeter was a good example. I remember I talked to Matt Riley on a podcast a couple of years ago, and how they sort of believe, they understand that because of the structure, the ownership of the club, the best they can hope for is third-tier football without compromising what the ethos of the club. And I think that's a great sort of way to look at it, you know, and the club is the fans, it belongs to the fans. Literally, financially, belongs to the fans. And I guess, you know, in some, you get these sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? You mentioned the phrase White Knight. I was thinking the two Hollywood stars who bought Wrexham, you know, and they, you know, they took Wrexham from the, you know, non-league into the fourth tier, third tier, whatever. And I always think with that sort of thing, though, it's destined to explode, because the fans will keep wanting to progress. And the money you have to spend each time to progress, they're going to get to the stage where they're thinking, you know, I mean, I think I've done enough of this hobby now, and they'll either sell it or it'll move on. So I guess, you know, the only true nice ownership for a football club is the fan ownership. Anybody else, I mean, I guess, you know, there's always going to be that sort of distance between the fans and the owners. Who the fans want something that the owners can either don't want or can't afford unless they're mega wealthy, because you're always going to want the next step. You know, the next rung on the ladder is always more attractive than the one you're standing on.
Yeah, I think that's so true, and especially if you see, you know, your neighbours down the road get a little bit of a cash injection in their club, you think, oh, actually, I want a piece of that. I want to try and get some of that. Matthew, is there anything else? I mean, Gary talked a little bit there about sort of Spanish ownership, where they've kind of got the fan-led model with a president. I mean, that doesn't always go well. I mean, you look at Barcelona and their financial disasters that they've had over the last 3 years, not being able to register players, going over salary caps. Is it something that needs to go hand in hand? Like, I don't know, let's say us three decided to buy a football club. We're probably not going to get that far, unless either of you two are secret billionaires and they're going to be on a Channel 4 sort of undercover show anytime soon. But you're only going to be able to get so far, because even a club like Birmingham, you know, you get promoted to the Premier League, you're only able to lose X amount of money a season. Doesn't matter if you're worth 10 billion or a billion. It's more about kind of how you can balance your books, and Nottingham Forest have kind of somehow managed to do it with signing 150 players, staying up for a couple of seasons and managing to keep their losses just about under, even though they had a points deduction as well. So is there always going to be limitations to that, or is there another model out there that we think actually this would allow someone to invest a great deal of cash and we can kind of keep it in that fan world?
That is a good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer. Just trying to think, any good examples out there? I don't think I can think of one. I think everything is so geared now towards success and, as you say, building to the next step. It's very capitalism in football. You know, it's all great. Last year we finished 13th and made this sort of revenue. Next year it has to be 10th, and we have to build up the money even more. It's the commercialization of the sport, which I think lends itself to a lot of cautionary tales. And I'm sure there is one, but I can't think of a good example right now, to be honest.
Yeah, you mentioned about Barcelona, being on the edge of bankruptcy. They were on the edge of bankruptcy, but still won the league 2 years ago. I think they got beat last night, actually. I certainly beat them, I think, 4-2, but they were top of the league this season as well. So, you know, and I'll come back to that in a second. But Real Madrid had a similar situation. I'm going back probably 10 years or so now, and they were on the edge of bankruptcy. And they sold their training ground to the local authority. Like they're called Las Vegas, which means the field. They sold it to the local authority. And the local authority then sold them an area to build a new training ground at a very reduced price. Now, they owed a lot of money. Barcelona, going back to Barcelona, owed a lot of money to the banks. And Real Madrid owed a lot of money to the banks. Are you going to be the bank that forecloses on a debt for Barcelona and Real Madrid? Because if you are, the fans of those clubs are going to take their accounts away from you very rapidly. And you know what it's all down to again? It's all down to reserving money.
It isn't, and it's the decisions made in the corridors of power, I suppose, isn't it, that are out of the fans' hands. The example that I was going to sort of share, which will obviously cause enormous derision, is Red Bull. So Red Bull. So obviously Red Bull in Germany, because they've got to follow the fan-led rules, which is still a little bit murky, because actually the more you delve into it, the more sort of you see they're not always 100% fan-led. But obviously, they've been a group that have invested an awful lot of money. They've got a really good model where they pick up players from literally any and every country in the world, develop them in their system, their style of play, and they sell them and they make money. And they've been able to compete at the top level a lot of the time in the leagues that they're in. But on the flip side, none of us would probably want to be called Red Bull Chelsea, Red Bull Birmingham, or Red Bull Middlesbrough. But actually, it would probably keep your club afloat. Maybe not Chelsea because they've already got loads of money anyway. But for smaller clubs, that's obviously a possibility. Now, obviously, the flip side of all of that is Red Bull had to find clubs from somewhere. So you could argue they just ignored the fans of the original clubs, if you like, took over their rights, changed the name, powered them up through the leagues. And actually, now they're a totally different entity completely. So there is that kind of sustainable model out there, but actually fans were left out of that as well.
A couple of things to mention about the Red Bull situation. I mean, first, the Red Bull Leipzig aren't called Red Bull Leipzig. They're called RB Leipzig, and they changed and I can't remember the German, but German is non-existent, but it means lawn game or something like that. So it's called RB, but it's not Red Bull. And the German model is often touted, but it applies in every instance except the ones it doesn't apply in. Wolfsburg were owned by Volkswagen, and they're given a variance to allow that to happen. Now, you either got rules or you haven't. And, you know, as I say, the German example has been touted, you know, and I can understand why, but if you're going to have a system, then have a system. And if you're going to make allowances, then you have not got a system. You haven't got a set of rules because you're just breaking them to keep, you know, a very large corporation happy and investing money in football. Cynical.
But what does that bring us to again? It's power. So it's all of the ownership rules are all around power. And that's what it's probably always going to be, isn't it? And I suppose at the minute, what we probably feel like as football fans is the power is residing in other countries. And I don't mean, you know, a rich American who comes with four friends who says, let's put in 20 million each and buy a championship club and then we'll invest X amount of money. I don't mean that. I mean the Newcastles, the Man Cities, where it is another country owns actual land in this country for sports reasons or non-sports reasons. And I think when you see regeneration, especially in a place like Manchester, it does look really appealing. But actually, shouldn't we be doing that? Because it's our country, our cities, our nation or whatever. And yeah, you know, we can't be naive to think that we don't get foreign investment. the power our railways and our whatevers. I mean, I don't think we own any of the energy companies that we get energy from in this country. So it's all that, and it's obviously a really complex situation. Football is by no means unique in the sense that foreign owners or states actually put funds into it. But I just think we're at a tipping point where maybe the competitive balance is going to be skewed so much the other way. And obviously everyone knows, I'm assuming the Premier League's got a 14-6 power sort of share and ratio where 14 clubs can get a rule over the line, as it were, or a decision made. Maybe those 14 clubs one day say, Super League looks really good for you. Off you go. We'll take a Middlesbrough and a Leeds and a Burnley and a Birmingham from the league below, and we'll have a Premier League without you in it. And that's it. And, you know, if you want to come back, you start in the non-league north or the non-league south or wherever, and you can work your way back up again. And maybe we get to a point where we say, actually, the league's got the power, not the clubs. And I think that's where, you know, dangerous things happen in terms of football. It'll be very interesting to see how that develops.
So I just wanted to add, there's 2 points I wanted to add to this. One, and I think we as fans often spend so much time talking about, I mean, this whole podcast is about ownership, but yeah, we've spent so much time talking about ownership that we sort of miss a larger point to it. Like, this is all just the de-romanticization of football. Like, I hear what you say about the Red Bull model, but there's nothing romantic about it. There's nothing fun. It's very clinical and commercial and sanitized, and which is what one of my big issues with the way that the Premier League is at the minute. It's so clean. It's so like, it's been football bred in a lab. There's no blood and thunder. There's no there's passion, but it's not. It feels very forced passion to me. It feels very sanitized is the only word that I can come up with, and it's something that really bothers me. I think the way that football is going, that everything is so clean and clinical. And then just before the next bit, I think you mentioned the 14-6 model. I think while I have absolutely nothing wrong with America as a country, well, I might do, but nothing wrong with Americans, and I absolutely adore American sports. Like, I'm wearing an NFL shirt right now. I love baseball. But the amount of American ownership in English football at the minute, I think, is going to be a problem in the future. We're already seeing lots of talk about, you know, playing games abroad. Even frigging the Birmingham owners wanted to move the Birmingham Wrexham game to the USA. And again, while this, I think, is not such a big problem in America, you know, recently there was a game in Brazil. But it's because in England, like I say, England, it's all, we are, the football clubs are representative of small communities, where in America, it's these are representing states. And it's like that it's always been treated as such. I think if this sort of trend carries on, we're going to start seeing a lot more very problematic things happening. I wanted to mention what's happened in baseball at the minute with the Oakland Athletics. They've been in Oakland, I think, 60, 70 years, big historic storied franchise that, very romantic. I mean, if I think everybody's seen Moneyball, they're the team from Moneyball, great story. They've won World Series, and their owner has moved them from Oakland to Sacramento, and then will move from Sacramento in a few years to Las Vegas. All because of, it's not even because of money, it's because vindictiveness against the fans, really, and because he wants the power, he has the power to do that. And we've seen that once in England already with Wimbledon and Milton Keynes, and I worry that sort of thing may happen in the future, where owners have so much power, so much money, so much whatever, that they can, like you say, they can break off and form their own leagues with teams from Saudi Arabia, from the Mediterranean. They can move, I know, Bayern Middlesbrough and say, well, the UK government doesn't fund anything in the north of England. Why should we? Let's move it down south to where, you know, more investment takes place. And in 10 years' time, I'd be amazed if something like that hasn't happened, where an owner takes a distressed asset, let's use that term again, moves it further south where there is more investment and more scope and more room to grow, I guess, is the horrible way to put it. And I think we're entering, like you say, a tipping point. And I would be very surprised if problematic things like that don't happen in the future.
I think there's a lot of interesting points there. I think on the RB, or I think Rasenball Sport is what they call the RB rather than the Red Bull. One thing I think is interesting about Red Bull as a model, as a group and an ownership group, I think they've particularly made their football that kind of hard pressing attacking style for that reason, to stop it from being a, you know, you've taken us over and what have you done? Actually, what we're doing is we're trying to put out the best, most exciting football possible. Therefore, you will support us because fans like to watch goals, attacking, etc. So I think that's part of the Red Bull thing. On the other point, I think in terms of the ownership structures that we're starting to see in England, I do think it's really interesting that, again, I follow the NBA really closely, and their ownership groups or owners are like 10 Abramovich's in one. Like it blows it out of the water completely. And obviously in American sports, there's a lot of different in terms of where the power is, because a lot of the power is in collective bargaining agreements with the players. The NBA, for example, they have a, I think it's at 51-49 revenue sharing model. So the owners get 49%, the players get 51%, which is split between their contracts, which sets the limit to pay, etc. But one of the big issues, and maybe this is a little bit about your point with investment, Matthew, in terms of different regions in the country. So a lot of local authorities, we would call them in England, but a lot of states end up paying for developments to the sports clubs. So, for example, I think it was in Sacramento as well, actually. I think they've been trying to build a new arena in Sacramento for the Kings for a long time. And partly it was from negotiations around who's going to pay for the actual new arena. And a lot of the time, it's actually the taxpayer who pays for it.
I think it's the Miami Marlins are building a new stadium. It looks incredible. It looks like state of the art, but it's going to be something like $2 billion from the taxpayer's pocket that is going to go towards it.
Yeah. So. And if you think about, you know, all those council taxpayers who, you know, don't have their bins collected once a week. Imagine they had to then say, we're going to build a, you know, an $80 million stadium on the banks of the River Tees because the riverside's got a bit old. It just kind of really shifts it. I mean, for me, I'm a little bit more that we need to be a bit more focused on some of the models in what America does in terms of revenue sharing, collective bargaining. But then we've got the PFA and FIFPro who just undermine a lot of that because they think the players should be able to maximise the value of the contracts, which is fine. But do you want football to be here in 50 years or not?
Yeah, because I think what you say is true, because I think there's a lot of stuff about cost controls and player caps, wage caps and stuff like that I think would be incredible in English football. And there's a lot of stuff that we can actually learn from American sports and bring some of that stuff over that would be so beneficial to football.
It's interesting you're saying about getting other people to pay for your stadium. I don't know if you recall, and not too long ago, Jim Ratcliffe was advocating that the local authority or local government or even national government should pay for the rebuilding of Old Trafford. And it sounded scandalous, but it's not the first time. West Ham play in what they call the London Stadium, which should actually be called the Taxpayer Stadium. And if that isn't bad enough, Manchester City play in a stadium that was actually built for the Commonwealth Games in Manchester and never paid, I believe it's the case, never paid a penny towards the construction of that. And let's face it, I mean, West Ham are wealthy enough, but my God, as if Man City couldn't afford to pay for their own bloody stadium. So, yeah, you know, we sort of say, no, when Jim Ratcliffe came out saying, it's scandalous, how very dare you? But, you know, it wasn't the first time.
No, it's not. And I think this is one of the precedents have been set already. He's not asking for money for Old Trafford on a whim. He knows it's happened before.
Of course.
You know, he knows. And I think he originally said, we need a Northern National Stadium, didn't he? So again, if you do it under that proviso, you think, well, actually, I live in the north. It'd be great if I could only travel an hour or 90 minutes to a national stadium rather than having to travel to Wembley for however many hours, you know, on our old rickety train lines that we've got up in the north that we have to chuck the coal on and pedal ourselves. But all those sorts of things have been around, like you say, Gary, for a long time. And I think once the precedent's been set, you can't pull it back. And I think for me, maybe controversially, for me, the Man City case is not about the punishment that Man City get. It's about what the Premier League do next. What are they going to do, whether it's in-house, sorting out who's actually looking at all these accounts returns, and if you haven't submitted them in 10 weeks after the deadline, you get a 10-point deduction. And also another one where it's like, oh, but that 10-point deduction affects the fans. Yep, it does. And as soon as they start booing the owners and throwing whatever at them, the owners will soon leave. That's the power that fans have got. They vote with their feet. They'll leave the stadium. We've seen it before with protests and whatever else. There's got to be some punishment from that point of view on the pitch for me. If you're not, you know, you've got to start pulling the two back together. That off-field ownership, that on-pitch play has got to come back together again rather than, oh, as fans, we want to spend $10 billion and be in the Champions League. You've got to marry the two because at the minute, I think we're sort of diverting too far across the two. And I think for us, from a podcast point of view, we're probably at a point for some final thoughts, for some final sort of closing ideas maybe. Matthew, I'll throw a couple of things at you and feel free to answer whichever. What do you think will happen with football club ownership in 10 years and the next 10 years? Or what would you like to see happen with football club ownership in the next 10 years?
Nice questions. I think nothing good will happen in the next 10 years. I think a lot of what has been detailed already, I can see, my bold prediction is that a relatively big team will be taken over by rich people and be moved from where they are, taken from the community and moved elsewhere to somewhere that has a bigger market area and greater scope for growth, which, I mean, it's a whole other podcast, but is an indictment on the British government and the lack of investment in certain areas of the country. What I want to happen, that I don't actually know. That's a good question. I do like the fan ownership is a good way to go. And I know Gary mentioned there are some issues with the 50-plus model in Germany, but for the most part, it is successful. And you do end up getting success stories like Heidenheim at the minute in Germany, a sort of amazing story going on there. And they are a fully, as far as I know, like 50-plus model working to with the best of its abilities. Definitely one thing I would like to see happen is a removal of all state ownership clubs. Not the clubs but themselves, but like let's remove the state ownership and let's not continue down that really complicated path of geopolitics and football being intertwined, where you have instances of our former prime minister helping the Saudi government buy Newcastle. I think that whole path is complicated and dangerous and has too many ramifications that a sport cannot handle. So that's the main thing I think I would want to see. Fan ownership would be great, but let's get rid of all the state-owned ownership.
And the same questions for you as well, Gary. What do you want to see in the next 10 years? What do you think we'll see in the next 10 years?
Well, I think the issue goes back probably 3 decades now. Football sold its soul. I think it's a phrase I've used so many times on podcasts. Football sold its soul. And the devil don't do sale or return. So you ain't getting that back. I think the issues we have regarding ownership is it's difficult to manage it because Premier League trying to organise and rule the clubs is like an antelope trying to organise a pack of lions. You've got no teeth and they've got all the teeth. I think, I agree with Matthew 100%, it'll only get worse because it can't be stopped. It'll only get worse. And I also agree with Matthew, it'd be great to say, you can't have countries owning football clubs. But I think if you get to almost any ownership of a fairly wealthy club, there's plenty of skeletons if you dig deep enough. What I would like to see is the fan ownership thing is the only possible salvation. And it's in the UK, not just in England, but in Scotland as well, and Wales and Northern Ireland, fan ownership exists, but only to a very low level. And it becomes like a self fact that it can't work at the higher level. It can't work. Well, have a word in Real Madrid. The best, biggest club in Europe. Perhaps not the most wealthy, but certainly the most successful. Barcelona as well, financially. So it can work, but where there's the will to make it happen is another thing. So, I think I agree with Matthew 100% of what he said, and the next big bad step, the next slippery slope step would be a rich owner, rich owners, rich country taking over a club and moving it somewhere else, perhaps even to America. Perhaps to another, not only within the country or to another country, and then you get that Super League situation recurring again. It's, I think, inevitably sometime down the road it's going to happen. Sad but true.
Thanks, Gary, and thanks, Matthew. There's a lot to unpick with this, and we may well return at some point in the season to this topic about ownership and where we're at, especially around the Manchester City charges and how the Everton takeover is progressing with their new stadium, everything like that. AFC Wimbledon's probably one to mention in our final thoughts, whose pitch, if anybody's seen it, looks like something from a Lynx golf course at the moment. But I know they've had quite a lot of crowdfunding they've managed to get together to try and fix it and get that sorted out. But what a story that is. Just one to mention that they've now got what looks like a brilliant stadium, fantastic football kits as well, if anybody's seen them, some great Umbro efforts there. So maybe there is examples out there. Let's hope. Maybe they can punch above their weight like the Wimbledon of the 80s and the 90s with that crazy gang spirit and get them back towards the top of the league. Well, thank you from myself, Gary and Matthew. And thank you all for listening to the Game podcast. We've had a little bit of injury time on this podcast today. We've played our first half. There's been a couple of injuries along the way. The refs added on a little bit more time for us to get in our opinions and our thoughts. So please do let us know what you think about this issue on our social media. And do, obviously, be active. think about where your club's going and what your club's doing. But obviously, enjoy the stuff on the pitch and maybe forget sometimes what's happening off it every now and again. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.